In a world where action films are dumped in theaters and TV, dead on arrival.
I can't go on living this lie.
You need a hero.
Last time I trusted someone, I lost an eye.
You need a helper.
Hello, hello. Nothing to see here.
You need a healer.
That is affirmative.
You need...
We're on the air.
Professor Rick's Action Film Autopsy.
All the bad ones.
Oh, no, most of them are pretty good ones. Hi, everybody. This is Rick Myers, and on my left is...
Miko Mai.
And on my right is...
Jen.
And we're here at the beautiful Bowtie Royale 6, the ultimate theater. We're going to go see Coco. True. And Jen was just telling me about John Lasseter. Oh, my God.
Wow. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Sad news.
It's so sad. And now I don't...
Disappointing.
I'm glad this stuff is coming out. And you, Jen, were saying that you knew about this for years.
Yeah.
The way I knew about Cosby and Harvey Weinstein. It's just, but you know, Harvey Weinstein, you could tell he was a monster.
Yeah.
But John Lasseter?
Yeah.
Jeez, no, what a shame.
It is such a beloved person.
How wretched. Well, let's go into more wretchedness. What do you want to do first in chronological order? Do you want to do Blade Runner 2049?
Sure.
I mean, you guys, I did the, I don't remember what I did for that one. I talked about it somewhere. I can't remember whether I already did it on the podcast, but what's your input on those, on that one? Did you like that?
I liked the story. Like, yeah. I liked some of the story points,
mm-hmm.
but I needed to watch the entire film on like 1.5 speed.
Oh yeah.
Just get the fuck
It's very
it.
Slow.
I was gonna say, for me, it's like I got into massive fights at work because there are people who are like, you can't appreciate the beautiful cinematography, and I was like, that's not about that. Like, there's a difference between like really nice ambient environment shots and beautiful cinematography, and then there's just getting from point A to point B. Yeah. I don't need to see you walk up the stairs and open the door and enter the building to know that you're in the fucking building.
If it doesn't serve the story, like, doesn't matter what the cinematography is.
You made
it
an
doesn't
ugh.
Make sense.
You made an ugh sound.
The reason why, because there's, again, like, it was boring. It was very boring. The only thing I like in there is the relationship between the...
Ryan
Gosling's guy, and the AI. That relationship was very touching.
And she was so brutally murdered.
I liked it because I was like, it's all fake, but or is it? But I was like, but probably. So that's I liked it for like a fucked up reason.
For me, it has the same issue as a lot of the films has, like a very simplistic villain again.
Yeah.
Someone just kind of stay in the background who's kind of crazy for crazy's sake.
Oh yeah, right. He felt like a sequel villain that like never actually comes to the surface in this one. Because they're saving him,
right?
And then now I heard it did so badly that it's probably not going to get a sequel. Anyway.
Well, I was always amazed that they thought it would do well.
I mean, I'm annoyed because like I was like, for me it was like I wanted it to go faster because I really just wanted to know the story,
right?
Because it was like so obvious that like what they were alluding to wasn't going to be what it was. So I was like, okay, like what's the twist? Is it this? Is it this?
Well, here's the deal. Of course, when I was your age, movies were slower. So, you know, I watched this movie on a 2001, A Space Odyssey speed, was, I just, and also the on the same thing as The Assassin, that Taiwanese movie with Xu Qi. I just leaned back and let it sweep over me.
An issue with genre then, because it's like, I remember being in film classes and like a lot of classmates having problems with like your standard like Japanese slice of life movies.
Oh, yeah.
But like, that's so cute. Sorry. Yeah. Sorry. There's a cute little Spanish boy putting on a Coco poster
getting
saying here in Spanish.
Yeah.
My God. I love it.
They may be in our show. Probably not. They just came out.
Yeah, no, he's too little.
But go ahead.
But yeah, and like, so it's not for lack of like being able to sit still so much as this is a thriller. This is a mystery. There are supposed to be lives on the line. And like, we're just taking it, just like the pacing and like the cutting, the editing just didn't feel like it didn't match like the weight of the situation at hand.
Yeah.
I was gonna say, like, not just that, just not the pacing itself isn't quite the issue, is the like what she said before, where like the point A to point B, because there are a couple shots of him just walking to a place. It's like, I get it, well, the design's amazing,
but
it's practical,
even, like, the,
but
like the kind of shots that you wanted. Like, there was only really one moment where he's walking through and you see that like Blade Runner, like the city, the Asian neon lights, like you know.
Oh yeah, this
so it
time
wasn't even that
this time in comparison to the last film, there isn't a lot of how people live anymore. I don't feel that sense of like how people live anymore.
Really?
It's a lot, it got pulled back a little bit.
I did.
It's a lot of city scale, but like not how people live in general. Because there's only one, I mean, there's only one scene of him in, you know, the middle of like sort of the town center eating noodle. But like Harrison Ford was chasing down, you know, like replicas through
but
the street and all that stuff.
The whole Soylent Green scene of him going to his apartment, I thought told me all I needed to know.
Okay.
But let me just quickly say that Denis Villeneuve was the director, and Hampton Fancher, who wrote the original Blade Runner and the Blade Runner video game, was one of the screenwriters, and Michael Green, who's known mostly for his television work like Smallville and American Gods, but also contributed to the screenplays of Green Lantern, Logan, and the recent Murder on the Orient Express, which we'll get to, interestingly enough, was the other screenwriter. Now, specifically for the podcast, the fighting was pretty darn good. The fighting at the beginning especially, because he's a programmed person who's designed specifically to go after replicants.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So his fighting with the other replicants was practical, it wasn't showy, and it was fast. But at the end of the movie, and by the way, the stunt coordinator was Joel Kramer, who did Terminator, Genesis, Westworld.
The fight with
Star
Harrison
Trek.
Ford.
And, well, more than, and the girl, whatever that
actually,
girl's
I like the fight with Harrison Ford.
That, it was funny.
Harrison Ford I liked too.
Yeah.
But the final fight.
With the girl.
I totally forgot about her.
That was super weird. But let me go on with the stunt coordinator, Joel Kramer, who did Terminator, Genesis, Westworld, Star Trek Discovery, Conjuring 1 and 2, so I like his work. Co-stunt coordinator is Mike Massa, who did The Force Awakens reshoots. He didn't do The Force Awakens.
He did the reshoots.
But then mostly TV. He did the long, doing the new show, The Long Road Home, which has some a lot of good war action, war foo, as I call it. So the final fights, there's two final fights where he suddenly stops fighting.
Fight in the thing while it's getting submerged. I forgot that movie. There you go.
Well, more than that, they fight in the surf first.
The
girl comes out.
Yeah.
The girl is the replicant assassin who's very sadistic and always cries when she kills someone, and cries a lot because she's constantly killing people, and in a very cruel way, in a very mean way. She's not well programmed. But there's a scene where they're outside of the little craft, which is on the beach. It's being drowned. It's being overwhelmed with water. Mm-hmm. And Harrison Ford's character is handcuffed inside, so he can't get. He's having a hard time breathing and surviving. Meanwhile, the girl's outside, repeatedly, one after another after another after another, kicking Ryan Gosling's character in the face with roundhouse kicks, spinning back kicks. They're called. She's standing in the surf and doing one spinning back kick after another, and he is taking every single one of them in the face. And I was just talking to somebody about how ridiculous the spinning back kick is, because the flaw in the spinning back kick is right in the title of the kick, spinning back kick. The moment your back is turned, you're done. But he's just standing there, letting her kick him repeatedly in the face. And everything else in this movie made sense and had a reason for it. I'm going, so is he deprogramming in front of her? Is he rebooting? They're not making it clear. But then you think he's done, and she comes in to finally kill Harrison Ford. And then, rising out of the surf, big surprise, comes his hand, grabbing her by the throat.
Oh, yeah, that.
And she does what all women do in action movies. She takes it.
Yeah.
In other words, he has his hand on her throat. He is holding her up above the surf, and he's choking the life out of her. You can see, now, prior to this, she was brutally effective. She was viciously, homicidally effective. Suddenly, she can't land a punch.
She's grabbing the hand, grabbing his face.
And she's not even grabbing his face.
No?
Because, you know, because if she did, what would you do? What would, especially a replicant like this?
I mean, dab him in the eyes.
Yeah, take both thumbs, press them into the eyes until she reaches the brain.
Yeah.
And it's like, none of that. And then she dies. And it's like, what?
Exactly. It was especially weird for me. Well, again, another cliche that I always see is that she had the perfect chance to finish him.
Yes.
The script wouldn't let her. Plus, like him rising from the water.
Yeah.
That's the stupidest thing you could do. I think he was also stabbed.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly.
He was pretty brutalized.
He was pretty brutalized. Laying on the beach.
Yeah.
He, or I guess the yeah. the dam, he has, there, where does that, all that power come from?
So I'm spending all my time trying to figure out what was the meaning of this? What was he trying to say? And you know, is he trying to commit suicide? He's just going to stand there and take the kicks in the face? And then she's going to just let him kill her because she has some sort of replicant guilt? I don't know. It's not clear.
I don't think any of that is.
And it kind of spoiled the thing for me. But now... Now we can go on to... Yes, go ahead.
Side note.
Yes.
They made San Diego a waste management system, and I don't like that.
I appreciated it.
Yeah.
No. Accurate.
You just don't like California in general.
It's a lovely place. You'll go to work for John Lasseter soon.
She's joking, though.
No, I'm joking, too.
I was thinking he is, too.
Yeah. But anyway, so now we're going to make the connection because Michael Green, who also wrote the new script of Murder on the Orient Express, so we'll jump over to Murder on the Orient Express.
Okay. Cool.
And the reason that's this, it's we figured that was not going to be on this podcast. It's Murder on the Orient Express. There are no fights in the Murder on the Orient Express. There are now. Mm-hmm. In this new version, they have several fights.
My favorite part was when Johnny Depp was repeatedly stabbed with a knife.
Spoiler alert, but you're, oh, we didn't do it. There'll be spoilers.
I mean,
there'll be spoilers. There'll be spoilers. There'll be spoilers. We have to do those all. Hold spoilers. Well, it's good. We want this film to be better, so there will be spoilers. Yes. Well, of course, anybody who saw the original, which I still prefer, I thought the original with Albert Finney and all this other fabulous things, cast was better scripted and better structured.
Mm-hmm.
This one's a bit messy, but it had fights. It had several fights,
mm-hmm.
and the fights were sharp, and they were interesting, especially, but the opening scene of the movie, you may have noticed this too, the ending falls apart again. The Hercule Poirot, as played and directed by Kenneth Branagh,
mm-hmm.
at the beginning of this movie is different than the Hercule Poirot at the end of the movie. Now, if you remember in the opening sequence, he sets up a whole mystery. They're establishing his character.
Yeah.
He puts his cane in the wall.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which he, because he already knows, he's thinking so far ahead
mm-hmm.
that when the person he's about to accuse of doing the crime, who turns out, of course, to be the person guilty of the crime, tries to run away, he tries to run back because he's trapped by a guard that Hercule Poirot sets up at the beginning of the sequence.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And he runs into the cane.
Mm-hmm.
And Hercule Poirot, like, knew everything that was going to happen. But suddenly, at the end of the movie, he doesn't know anything. He doesn't know anything.
I like that.
I didn't, because he's Hercule Poirot.
I don't know. That means nothing to me.
Okay.
And for me, I went into this kind of being like, oh, this is an old Agatha Christie book. Murder mysteries back then were probably a lot stupider than they are now. Because
no,
they
they're
could,
a lot
smarter. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
But I meant like in terms of like... What
I think
they
they're
could
more
do because
less simplistic.
Well, yeah, yeah.
I wouldn't say stupid.
I don't mean okay, stupid.
They're
is
still
a strong
really
word.
Good, but they don't have that many like pile on layers that we tend to do
they
now.
They don't. Well,
which
no.
Doesn't mean they're
what
not.
What happened was that Agatha Christie.
I mean, I was expecting to be able to like solve this as we were going.
Yeah.
So when more and
no,
more shit
allow,
was being
they
revealed,
didn't allow you to do it.
And there were more and more like coincidences, yeah. I was like, okay, this shit isn't a coincidence. And then I just got mad because I was like, I wanted to solve the mystery. And
you could have solved
it.
The mystery on the original. You should go see the original, the 1974 version.
Okay.
Which again, better scripted, better structured. However, what the reality of the mystery field at the moment is that Agatha Christie and Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler and Rex Stout and Ellery Queen, they create, and other people like Dorothy Sayers, they wrote every possible plot imaginable.
Oh, I bet.
You cannot create a new mystery anymore. Mm. I did it in my book, Murder,
that's true.
My Dungeons & Dragons book, Murder in Hal Rua. I prided myself on doing a three-level Ellery Queen-style mystery, but also I did something in that book that was totally unique in the history of the mystery, although the mystery itself wasn't unique because they've, believe me, I've read all their stuff repeatedly. Mm-hmm. There's no plot that you can come up with that they haven't
that's
done.
That's true.
So what we have in the modern mystery now is character. We have navel-gazing. We have guys who are drunk and tortured and depressed and you know, so it's all about character now.
Sure,
it's,
sure,
it's
sure.
Not about the mystery any longer because
yeah,
the mystery's
at
been
first
done.
He was like kind of off-putting because I was like, oh, it's just like a
because he's supposed to be.
Well, no, I understand that.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, his like for me, like that was kind of like a breakdown of like that kind of tropey like
yeah.
Sherlock, like perfect like character.
Right.
So I really appreciated that like he kind of had like humanity slap him in the face.
Yeah, however, even on Sherlock, the new Benedict Cumberbatch one, he fights in character.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Poirot did not. Poirot in the books is very clearly delineated in that he's very... That opening scene is Hercule Poirot of the books.
Yeah.
He's got... He uses his little gray cells. He's much smarter. As he says at one point very quietly, I may be the... I don't know if he says I may be. He may just says I'm the greatest detective in the world.
He does. He says that.
And, you know, and he is. And so I wanted him to fight like the greatest detective in the world.
Full disclaimer, I did not finish the whole film because I was sick at the time.
That's
but
right, you were.
What was the fight scene? Because I do remember, I mean, I still, because I finished, I sort of watched the end of it,
yeah,
where there wasn't any fight, but he actually is setting up the gun for the woman to shoot. That was, for me, that flashback to the first scene.
Yeah, that was similar, but not the fights. There were several, there are two fights, two major fights. One fight didn't involve him, but one fight did involve Poirot.
Okay.
The prince character suddenly does this wild martial art kick at one point to get somebody out of his room on the train. But then Josh Gad's character, who does the voice of Olaf in Frozen, he was playing Johnny Depp's secretary.
Right.
He pretends that he's the only villain and tries to get away by starting a fight, by hitting Poirot and having a big chase all over
the rafters.
The rafters and all that stuff.
The train is up on
a bridge. And it wasn't a bad little fight. I will tell you that Murder on the Orient Express, the fight supervisor was James Embry, who was the double for Daniel Craig in Spectre, for Brad Pitt in Allied, and Jason Statham in Mechanic Resurrection. And the stunt coordinator was James O'Donnell, who also worked on Allied and The Man from U.N.C.L.E. So, as usual with this kind of stuff, Poirot does not fight like Poirot. Poirot fights like the fight supervisor, James Embry, the double. So he fights like Daniel Craig and Brad Pitt and Jason Statham. And it's like, no, he should fight like Poirot.
See, and this is one of those things where, like, he's, like, sitting there, and I'm just like, they're, like, having fisticuffs in the train compartment. Like,
yeah.
Well, and he's, like, analyzing, and I'm like...
That sounds like...
That's what I do.
He wasn't fighting smart. He was fighting, like, brute force type.
No, he wasn't doing really brute force. He was reactive. But it was generic. You couldn't say that it was specific to him.
I see.
When Sherlock fights on the Sherlock television show, and even on the old Jeremy Brett PBS Sherlocks or BBC Sherlocks, you could tell it's Sherlock Holmes fighting.
Right.
He doesn't suddenly turn into Jason Statham and James Bond and the mechanic. He stays that character. He fights the way that character would. Poirot would fight like Poirot, which is he doesn't like blood. He likes to be very efficient and very specific. Mm-hmm. You know, Poirot is one of these guys who supposedly he had OCD before it was OCD.
Yeah.
I mean,
clearly.
Oh, right. Yeah. Well, in the beginning, he says everything needs to be balanced out, even the justice.
So the whole thing about he enjoyed the movie, Jen. he had that whole thing about making sure the eggs were exactly the same height at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
So he should have fought that way, and he did not, and so I was disappointed. So now we can go on to the main attraction for this podcast, which is the double feature of superheroes.
That's
right. What do you want to start?
I don't even know what you're fucking
talking about. What do you want?
Let's start with Thor.
Let's start with that.
Wait, happy notes? Okay.
Thor. Let me tell you. Everybody knows.
Taika.
Yeah, directed it. But now, the stunt coordinator was Ben Cook, who did Assassin's Creed. And what's interesting, listen, he was also the stand-in. The other guy, James Embry, was the double for Daniel Craig in Spectre, where he fought terribly. And Ben Cook, the stunt coordinator on Thor Ragnarok, was Daniel Craig's double in Skyfall, which were much better fights.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Much better. So the fight coordinator was, he was also fight coordinator on Thor Dark World and Jupiter Ascending.
Mm.
Then also the other stunt coordinator, there's several.
Sensing
is Kyle
here.
Gardner, who did Alien Covenant, Kong, and Hacksaw Ridge, which had a heck of a stunt coordination. Fight coordinator reshoots were Daniel Hernandez, who did Affinity, and he was brought on from Avengers Infinity War 1 and 2.
Mm-hmm.
So he was, when they did the reshoots, they obviously said, just use our guy. He's still working on Avengers right over here, so bring him on. So Daniel Hernandez has not done a lot of stuff. He did a lot of stunt work, but he has not done a lot of stunt coordination. So I'm kind of interested now to see if he separates himself from the pack.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, it's fascinating that when Ben Cook was Daniel Craig's double in Skyfall, the fights are much better in Thor than they were in Murder on the Orient Express, because The James Bond of Spectre and the James Bond of Skyfall, completely different. And we'll get a little bit more into that when I do my solo little piece on The Foreigner and Blade of the Immortal. We have to go to a movie with these guys, so I'm gonna add a little section on those two movies in a little bit. So anyway, what's your opinions of Thor Ragnarok?
It was fine.
You know, they can't see your face on a podcast.
I know, but I feel like that even in itself says something.
She made a little frowny face.
Frowny face, yeah.
She did an emoji. It was a living gen emoji.
Well, no, because for me it was kind of like this, it was like a very safe
what?
Marvel movie. For
what?
Me. Yeah, sorry. No, I'm not saying I didn't enjoy it.
No, but it's calling that safe is insane.
Oh, sure. I mean, sorry.
Safe? How is that safe?
Because everybody's going for this kind of, like, pseudo-edgy, like, funny kind of wink and nod at the audience kind of humor.
Nobody's going through that.
They are because... Yeah, no, and, like, they're fucking everywhere in the theaters. So, like, for me, it's kind of like, okay, like...
What? Like, what is she talking about, Mikko?
I think she's
everybody's
referencing...
Everybody's doing dark now.
I think she's referencing to Guardians of the Galaxy and how successful that was.
And Spider-Man. Everybody's doing this now.
Well, not everybody, just Marvel.
Okay, cool, but they're fucking everywhere now.
Like, they're not in Justice League. Well, they are now.
I was like, yes, they are.
Now they are. Well,
they kept every Flash little, like, hijink that he did, and they didn't cut a single Flash thing.
Well, the guy who did the Avengers.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. So, I mean, for me, it was just, again, like, it was kind of funny.
It was totally different.
But it was...
It was literally the same plot of the first Thor.
Well, they do that a lot.
They do that a lot.
I mean, Doctor Strange is the same as Iron Man.
But that's what I'm saying.
But it's all the texture. It's the same thing with every mystery I've already
done. There's nothing wrong with,
you
like they remixed. It was a lot of the same elements that they remixed to make something slightly different that I enjoyed. But then I'm just saying in this that there were certain things that I was just like, okay.
Okay. I was very delighted. I was charmed throughout. I enjoyed it immensely. Everybody was having fun. However, guess what the one thing I had a problem with?
And guess what I didn't have a problem with?
The action.
Why didn't
you have a problem with the
action? I have a problem
because,
with the action.
I just was like, they fight. That's what they do.
Well, you're not really looking at it.
What is this podcast called? Are you being an autopsier? No, you're not. You're being a stand to the cider.
And
looking at the operation.
No,
and not
but
doing
like
SWAT.
That's the thing though. Something like fight, like that's one of those things where like I personally don't have the knowledge or the experience that either of you have. So for me, it's.
But how do you feel about the fights?
You reacted exactly right. In other words, you just went, "Oh, they're fighting."
Yeah.
And it shouldn't be that way, should it?
I mean, part of it is like.
That's a good point.
But I think for me, like, I mean, I guess this goes to like your.
My whole point.
Well, no. I would say your point about like a fight should like help move the story along. Where like for me, it's kind of like I know where the story has to go. Like while you know when the fight starts, it's like you know how it's going to end because you know like well they're not going to kill each other. They have to get out. So like you know
it
this stuff is going to happen.
It doesn't have to move the plot along, but it has. In order for it to be a good fight scene, it has to be exciting.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be interesting. It has to be evolving. You should be able to go, oh, yeah, look at that. Oh, because I know Thor acts this way and Hulk acts this way. Then that makes sense that Hulk would do that. And that would make sense that Thor did that. And it would make sense that they would have a problem with each other because Thor does this and Hulk does. I mean, even in Fast and Furious, the last Fast and Furious, I was talking about how they really nicely showed you Jason Statham's character, and then they showed you The Rock's character, and they never deviated from their approach. One was Hercules,
their fighting style is very...
one was Bruce Lee, and they both did it. And so it allowed for scenes of pleasure.
Right.
It allowed me to have big smiles on my face because they were fighting in character. Here, it's the Hulk versus Thor, and a punch in the jaw is the best you can do.
Yeah.
It's just very, and also, I mean, the jokes with the Hulk I found immediately amusing. In other words, he doesn't, the whole thing about the Planet Hulk storyline where Hulk can talk and Hulk is aware that Banner's inside of him.
Yeah.
That's all interesting. But then...
But they hardly touched on it.
Yeah. And
they
then,
also hardly touched on Bruce Banner, like, missing 2 years of his life, which is like me, but I understood would weigh down the happy film.
Yeah, and when he goes down and when he falls to try to turn back into the Hulk again, this is the other thing. I wrote the Incredible Hulk novel, Cry of the Beast. To my knowledge, I think it's the only Incredible Hulk novel there is. And my whole thing in that book was to make it very clear why he changes.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't change into the Hulk because he's in pain.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the television show and most of this movie, he changes because he's in pain. he gets angry.
Mm-hmm.
He has to get angry. And as you guys know, who you suffered pain and you suffered anger, they're different.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
So he falls and smashes to the walkway,
Rainbow Bridge.
The Rainbow Bridge.
Which was, like, annoying.
Yeah,
like,
because, you know, all I wanted, I know, because it was a joke, but
that's
what I'm
saying. It's like you're so aware of the kind of jokes that they do now,
yeah,
that, like, the jokes aren't funny because you're just like, for me, it's like that would have been a really cool, sincere cinematic moment to just see him transform and
yes,
fight the cute wolf dog.
But also, that was
that
also
didn't deserve to die.
That's right. It's also a Jar Jar Binks humor. It's Jar Jar Binks humor, which is, you have to learn what humor is. Jar Jar Binks only works if he's trying not to fall down,
mm-hmm,
not
mm-hmm,
if he always is falling down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If he's trying not to fall down, but then fate conspires against him to make him fall down, mm-hmm, then you suddenly care about him, you're involved with him, and you can build, like, Buster Keaton-esque,
yeah,
Harold Lloyd, Charlie Chaplin-type humor. Here's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
The Hulk falls. All I wanted, all I just wished for, all we had to do is go to his crushed little face on the Rainbow Bridge and goes, that makes me, you just have to say, that makes me mad, and then turn into the Hulk.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't even show him turning.
Yeah, they don't show him turning.
And so,
see,
I was disappointed.
So for me, yeah, that goes back into, like, how the story is.
Yeah.
Like,
we all agree it's a good movie. We enjoyed the movie.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No,
yeah, but,
yeah, I enjoyed the movie. But like, the story feels really flat.
I would have loved to have seen this film if written by the director.
Yes.
Because that was the one thing I saw in interviews. Like, he avoided the writing for this. Like,
he may do it if they do it, give him another,
yeah,
one.
Yeah. I would really,
I don't
like
know if that's
that
good or bad. Because for
I
me,
think it's good because all his other films, like, they managed to, like, balance that, like, humor and,
yeah,
like, the heart.
Sure. I think that might be it. But, like, for me, this film, like, the story, again, like you said, the Planet Hulk, that,
yeah,
story is great. But, like, they really skip a lot of major heartwarming moments with,
yeah,
immediate jokes.
Right.
Same thing with, like, with the Hulk. Like, again, like,
yeah,
there could have been,
they refuse to linger on anything.
Yeah,
yeah,
they could refuse to have any, like, sort of good moments, let it, like, kind of foster. Instead, they cut into a quick joke.
Yeah.
So the whole thing feels very episodic for me.
Yeah.
None of it really connects really well.
And
so,
yeah, and we can't linger either because we only got 10 minutes before the movie starts.
Okay.
And unlike some people I can name, I like seeing previews.
I actually am excited for the previews for this one.
Okay, so anyway. So we have one more to talk about, and this one is a hoot. I call it a Jekyll and Hyde hoot,
mm-hmm,
which is Justice League. And I could spend the next 10 minutes just reading to you all the different fight coordinators and stunt arrangers and coordinators because...
I see you. Yeah, you're on the third
wow,
page.
It's a long
it's
list.
It's a long list.
Yes, right. The stunt and fight coordinator is Freddy Bouchier-Guiz, mostly stuntman, but he did Midnight Texas and Grimm on television. Stunt coordinator is Damon Caro, who did Man of Steel, Batman vs. Superman, and Wonder Woman. Fight choreographer is Wayne Dalgleish, who did Wonder Woman, and he was assistant on Batman vs. Superman. Stunt coordinator is Eunice Hothart. Oh, listen, I'll just list it on the supplemental, guys. It goes on forever because we have huge teams of them. We have them for the
mm-hmm,
Zack original, we have them for the Zack reshoots, and we have them for the Josh Whedon reshoots.
Joss, not Josh.
Joss. I said Joss, didn't I?
You said Josh.
I didn't mean to. I'm sorry, Joss. But you apparently are a sexist, too, so what are we going to do?
I saw that, yeah.
So anyway, I saw the parts that I felt were Zack. I didn't enjoy because I haven't enjoyed any stuff from Zack. Oh, the final thing, I think we both reacted to the final thing that nobody else has mentioned, which is they had Zack Snyder's production company card at the very end of the movie,
mm-hmm,
which is Cruel and Unusual Films.
Oh.
And they have a little, that's what it's called, and
yeah,
not surprising. And they have as its logo one of the characters,
like,
from Sucker Punch.
Yeah. The, like, little weird anime girl with the sword.
Yeah, and it's, and,
like,
but it's also
this... not quite Go-Go from Kill Bill, but, like...
But
that logo's always...
But wildly sexist. He changed the costumes of Wonder Woman as the Amazons and Wonder Woman to the Zack Snyder style, which is... He's trying to be Michael Bay with superheroes.
Yeah, it was weird.
And
I
it's
got
really,
that vibe, too.
And it's like, I'm
the
so
Amazonian
glad he's gone.
Too, right?
That's what you're talking about.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And,
I
you
think
know,
my hot take on this film,
yeah,
though, was I didn't hate it, which is... something that I've been seeing a lot on
no,
the
No, I didn't hate it either, but it was a mess. And it also shows the flaws. I mean, I'll put a link on the supplemental for Entertainment Weekly, 17 questions. They had 17 questions, which were very amusing. I love the fact that Superman is back in his original form,
mm-hmm,
that he's no longer a depressive, manic depressive.
Mm-hmm.
But I will mention something that, again, nobody else can really mention, and I apologize to everybody for this, but I want everybody to remember that not everybody. I just like to point out, and understandably so, that he left the production supposedly because his daughter committed suicide.
Yeah.
There's a reason that a daughter commits suicide, and given the way Zach has treated women in his movies, especially Sucker Punch and others, I'm not making any connections, but I'm just going sad, super sad, tragically sad, but it's something that piques my interest.
I'm not sure how much reshoot has been done, but I still like Wonder Woman in this film. Like they do have a huge chunk of the movie. Like she's in there.
Because they know people are coming to see this because of her. That's why
She was integrated since Batman vs Superman. Right. So like I get that she's in this a lot more.
I feel it's clear that the message from Warners to Joss was save Superman, make Wonder Woman the focal point.
Right. She definitely is. Yeah. Batman didn't even get sort of like the iconic fight.
I wouldn't have been surprised if the last shot of Batman wasn't Ben Affleck. Because he looked like he was leaving the movie throughout the entire movie.
I mean, the fact that like they give Wonder Woman that first, 5 minutes of the film, like of her fighting, showing like she's at, cleaning up the statues and whatnot. Yeah. That makes me feel like, they really want to try to focus on her more than
apparently
Batman.
The original cut was like 3 hours.
Wow.
And so they had something for everybody.
Yeah, I'm surprised they cut it down quite a lot. It's only 2 hours long.
He was instructed to make it 2 hours.
But it's also very, again, like a lot of, like the middle part is very episodic too. It's like, we got to hit this point, hit this point.
But
I was kind of bored of the middle.
That's like the challenge of like a multi-character film like this. Like that's like Guardian. I had this, as much as I love Guardians of the Galaxy 2, like that was my problem, was it was like checkboxes they had to hit for each character.
Yeah,
but at the same time, I understand that you guys come from a studio, but Guardians of the Galaxy 2, I felt, wasn't so much checkboxes. For me, it was like, well, I may not get to do a third one of these.
They were natural, but like it was
definitely. Yeah,
but
it was more of
my feeling about Guardians of the Galaxy 2 was that he said, I'm going to put everything I have ever wanted to put in a Guardians of the Galaxy movie in this movie,
in
case I never get to do it again or I don't want to do it again.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, so, Justice League is...
I did like the final fight. Sorry, I cut you off.
No, quite all right. That's quite all right. A Jekyll and Hyde hoot. I found it a Jekyll and Hyde hoot. It was better than what they had done before, because people weren't just punching. They were using powers.
Yeah,
but I attribute that to Joss.
I really felt that. I felt that, again, channeling, like, you.
They were,
I felt like they were using... They were fighting, like, in their styles. And
in
I felt
style,
like the way that they worked together, like... was nice kind of thing, because I feel like a lot of the times with these types of movies it's like ragtag group is assembled and like they don't get along, but like they have to,
and again they did,
and like it wasn't really like, obviously Aquaman was kind of the difficult one, but like he came around pretty fast, which was like
And they did the cool Marvel Doctor Strange thing of using Kung Fu at the end, where hoisting the villain by his own petard. They made the villain feel fear, which caused it. So that was cool.
Well, even though I hated the villain.
The villain was
generic.
The thing with
generic.
The power cube, like kind of just that whole like structure with like...
That was nonsense.
You have to get the MacGuffins. And then literally the part where they brought Superman back and then they left the MacGuffin in the facility and then the thing just comes and takes it and you're like... fucking kidding?
You guys have got to read the 17 questions that Entertainment Weekly had for
Which
Justice
I know,
League. Yes.
Thor Ragnarok also had a horrible villain, but anyway.
Yeah, I mean, well, but they had some interesting characters as the villains.
They wanted to give her a little bit more, but like the way that they presented her, she was so bland, so like one-dimensional for me.
I mean, when Steppenwolf appeared, I literally for half a second thought it was
the same Arius, the guy from Wonder Woman. It really is a little too similar for me.
But what's so great in Thor is they had Led Zeppelin. I wish that was fantastic. But I wish in Justice League they had Steppenwolf.
That would have been great.
Born to be wild. Or whatever. Let's wrap up.
And for me, like
we're going to move.
How powerful Superman is. It's funny because they pushed him off as long as they could. They did a pretty good job of letting all the other ones fight before Superman comes in, because he could have swept the floor with everyone. There's no contact.
And by the way, I've never seen Henry Cavill look happier. Really, he's been waiting all his life
to
play Superman.
Fake CG mustache.
Well, that was. I said, you know, what is that caterpillar? He's got a caterpillar on his upper lip. What is going on with that?
Rubber.
Yeah,
upper
it was
lip.
A little rubber upper lip. No. But even so, he smiles in this.
Oh yeah.
Cavill has gone on record. He thought Man of Steel was going to tank. He thought he'd never work again. And he wanted to play Superman. He didn't want to play a manic depressive.
Yeah.
So now he gets to play Superman. And literally, I can feel his happiness through the screen. But anyway, so we will continue this podcast with Blade of the Immortal and The Foreigner, which you'll hear very quickly. And for now, let's do our sign-off. And I'll do the sign-off again. Or you can just do your part of the sign-off, and then I'll do my sign-off when I do my little section.
We don't have a sign-off.
Yes, you do. What do you say after I say the thing? Now you say you lean in and go...
And chew your food, Rick?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Nailed it.
Now, where were we? Ah, yes. Well, it's the next day. We've seen Coco, which was really pretty extraordinary. I may get into that in a little bit. Maybe I will, maybe I won't. But the whole idea is it's just me now, Rick Myers, in my office, talking about the remaining two films that I've seen, but Miko and Jen didn't see. And the first being The Foreigner, directed by Martin Campbell, written by David Marconi, who wrote for the G.I. Joe TV show. He also wrote the Will Smith Enemy of the State. And then he didn't do much of anything for 6 years until he did the story for Live Free or Die Hard. In any case, I think you probably, if you know about the movie The Foreigner, which is starring Jackie Chan and Pierce Brosnan, and it's basically Jackie Chan meets James Bond, although not really James Bond, but Pierce Brosnan, who played James Bond, and also was introduced to the part of James Bond by the director of The Foreigner, Martin Campbell, in the movie GoldenEye. Martin Campbell is a greatly underrated director as far as I'm concerned. I've enjoyed most of his work, and I've always found it just dreadful how ignominiously he was thrown under the bus by Warner Brothers and blamed almost entirely for the failure of the Green Lantern movie, which he also directed. But he also directed two of the best James Bond movies. Many say arguably the best James Bond movie ever made, Casino Royale with Daniel Craig. That was also directed by Martin Campbell. So the fact that he did GoldenEye, which was a great James Bond movie, starring Pierce Brosnan, and I think unarguably Pierce Brosnan's best James Bond movie. Sadly, all the subsequent Pierce Brosnan James Bond movies, I may have mentioned this before, were sabotaged behind the scenes through no fault of his own, I believe. Although given the state of the industry at the moment in terms of things that are being revealed, and we'll may get into that a little later too, who knows, it may have been through some fault of Pierce's, but I don't think so, and I hope not, and certainly not Martin Campbell. So he's doing The Foreigner, which it's really interesting. We have a podcast coming up where I interview two English filmmakers, and their response to The Foreigner is completely different than the response I've heard from Americans. Because The Foreigner is about English politics. It's about Ireland and England and the conflicts there, the insane conflicts that have been going on for decades and decades. And their response to it has been one of, this is ridiculous. This is an absurd movie. And it's interesting, the response in Hong Kong is somewhat similar. In that the political upheavals they're going through with the now it's been 20 years since the Chinese have taken over the control of Hong Kong. And so they love Jackie, but they're not too sure about all this Irish-English intrigue that goes on in the movie. But we're here really for the action. I enjoyed the movie. I think even though the English completely disagree with me, I think it's one of Pierce Brosnan's best performances. They say his Irish accent is absurd. He is Irish, and he apparently has an Irish accent, but he's not doing in apparently his Irish accent in this movie. But I thought he was great, and I thought Jackie was great, because Jackie, despite not letting his hair go its natural color for his age, and he is what now, 63? Yeah, 63. I think he turns 64 next April. He plays his age, which he rarely does. Even in his more recent Chinese-made films, he's still trying to play
39, as the old joke goes. Jack Benny, who was a great comic on radio and television and in some movies, he always had the joke. He was always very vain about his age, at least his character was, his comedic character was. And he always says he was 39, no matter, you know, he's obviously in his 60s, but he's going, I'm 39. And that's what Jackie seemed to be doing throughout his last few films. But in this one, he plays his age. And unlike the film he did with Johnny Knoxville recently, it'll be in the supplementals. We've talked about it before. He doesn't just look old, he acts old. But he's also playing a character who has been trained as basically a secret agent or a military man, the original wolf warrior, as it were. And he plays that straight. He plays it well. And he's already gone on record that his new stuntman team, it changes over the years, supplied the choreography for this one. But also they were backed by a gentleman named James Grogan, who is one of the great veteran English stunt coordinators. He has more than 115 credits, including the recent Hitman's Bodyguard and Avengers Age of Ultron. Basically, if you go into England, you may be working with James Grogan, and you should be pleased you are. And he worked apparently with the Jackie Chan stuntman team seamlessly. And the highlight, the centerpiece of the film in terms of action, was a fight in a house and on a stairway where Jackie has moved to Ireland to corner Pierce Brosnan's politician and is staying in a bed and breakfast type of place. And a bunch of highly trained operatives are going in to kill him. And Jackie fights them and avoids them and falls off the house and all sorts of other things. And it's a really good fight scene. It's a real solid fight scene. But it looked familiar to me. And then I realized it basically, and I think Jackie did this on purpose with Martin Campbell's cooperation, it's an homage to the stairway fight scene in Casino Royale. If you go back and see that, and it's well worth it. It's interesting. James Bond's martial arts have never been better than when they're in Martin Campbell movies. The martial arts in GoldenEye were exceptional from the rest of the Bond series, as was Casino Royale. And so you can imagine, for me especially, it's doubly disappointing to see that the martial arts completely go away in the subsequent James Bond films. In Tomorrow Never Dies, which had Michelle Yeoh and Philip Kwok, who was one of the head Venom from Five Deadly Venoms, they were on set. Philip Kwok was doing the choreography. And suddenly James Bond goes back to doing roundhouse punches, and at no point during the film do they teach each other. He teaches Michelle Yeoh roundhouse punches, ridiculously, and she teaches him how to do it more effectively using kung fu? No. And the kung fu in the movie also is very aggressive. As usual, it seems to me that Philip Kwok, rather than saying, this is what you should do, he said, what do you want me to do? And naturally, they want him to do mixed martial arts or whatever. But in any case, and then in Casino Royale, again, James Bond is back to doing awesome, obviously secret agent trained martial arts. And then in the next film, Quantum of Solace, of all things, which is one of the worst James Bond movies, in my opinion, he's back to doing nonsense. And then in Spectre, I've talked about this before, I'm sure. I've certainly talked to my friends about this. James Bond has an ice pick at one point, and rather than using it the way you're trained, anyone would train you to do it underhand, he goes overhand, holding it up like a hammer. It's just nonsense in any case. But let's get back to The Foreigner. The Foreigner, I think, especially for people who are ignorant of the political situation in Ireland and England, is a pretty entertaining little film. And it's got some real tough edges to it. And Martin Campbell, whose work I respect, especially his work on television, he's done some really impressive television stuff, which I'll put on the supplementals, of course. Does a fine job, and the fight scenes are pretty good. They're not particularly memorable, but they're solid and strong, and Jackie fights in character, and the other characters who kind of generic They fight that, you know, in a way that they were obviously trained to fight as military people or as police officials. And it's I think it's well worth seeing. Now, but we come to the real wild card. I'd be impressed if any of you have seen this, but I highly recommend that you do. I saw Blade of the Immortal, which is being promoted like as Takeshi Miike's. We'll spell it. It'll be on the supplementals, but Miike is M-I-I-K-E. It's being advertised, this movie, Blade of the Immortal, as Miike's 100th film. And I'll be putting a lot about him in the supplementals because he is an awesome director, incredibly versatile. This is a samurai movie based on a manga and anime. Let me see if I have that information. Hiroaki Samura did the manga and also wrote the TV series manga. And he was even an animator on two episodes of the anime TV series of Blade of the Immortal. So he's got Blade of the Immortal all over the place. The actual screenwriter of this live-action film is Tetsuya Oishi. He has more than 40 TV credits, as well as screenplay credits on two Death Note films. I have to assume those are the anime Death Note, because I heard the new live-action Death Note is really pretty bad. But Blade of the Immortal is, to my mind, and I think to many American fans' eyes, is a natural follow-up to Miike's adaptation of a classic samurai film called 13 Assassins. And I just strongly recommend, I like 13 Assassins even more than Blade of the Immortal. And it is, I think, readily available on DVD and Blu-ray. And I highly recommend that you get it. And again, I'll try to put the link to that in the supplementals. But Blade of the Immortal is a anime, manga, and now live-action movie about... it's a fantasy. It's about a guy, a samurai, who, well, to go into the background of this, I'll again let you look up the plot on your own through the supplementals. But he meets an old woman who is basically a witch of the forest, who puts a bloodworm in him that fixes every wound he gets. So his style of fighting is to draw his opponent in, let his opponent basically kill him, and then surprise his opponent by not dying and then killing him back. And since the villains, the opponents don't have bloodworms in them, that's a pretty effective technique. Meanwhile, the choreographers is Deguchi Masayoshi, who worked on the Sailor Zombies TV miniseries. Of course, this is all in Japan. And Kiji Tsuji, who did Yakuza Apocalypse, 13 Assassins, the previous samurai remake that Miike made, as well as Miike's The Great Yokai War, which is another, it's a kids' action movie. I mean, Miike has done so many different things. He does kids' movies to anime adaptations to video game adaptations to samurai movies. He does everything. He does it equally well. And when I say equally well, he does it exceptionally well. He does these wildly bloody movies, these astonishingly violent, sex-drenched films, but he does them like most Japanese, since the Japanese don't have a lot of shame. They don't come from a Puritan heritage the way Americans do. They just want to do things of great quality. They don't care what the subject matter is. If the subject matter is decadent and sadistic and perverse, they don't mind. They're just going to do it artfully, and they're going to do it with no guilt and no shame. And that's what makes the best of their work so exceptional. Unfortunately, their cinema has for the last, I don't know, decade or more, has sort of like been on life support. They used to make these, the glory days for me, from an American standpoint, for the Japanese cinema, was in the 60s through, I guess, the 90s again, kind of like the way the Hong Kong cinema was. I may be incorrect on this, but basically from the 60s to the 80s, they had some of these astonishing samurai action series, Zatoichi, Lone Wolf and Cub, both of which has box Criterion sets of Blu-rays and DVDs, which again strongly recommend. But they just did massive amounts of really cool movies from samurai movies to Yakuza movie, which is their mafia type movies, their gang type movies, and police procedurals, romances, comedies, everything. And they did them all equally well. And Blade of the Immortal is kind of like a last gasp. It starts with a slaughter of dozens and ends with a slaughter of hundreds. As a matter of fact, the promotional material, the posters and the advertisements in Japan basically advertise the fact that it ends with the slaughter of 300 people, stuntmen, let's hope. And it's a little messy, as you might imagine. Blade of the Immortal is also somewhat famous for the esoteric weapons that the leading character uses, manji. They have all of those in the movie. So there's not unlike 13 Assassins, which has a very limited use of weapons. It's samurai swords and arrows and the occasional rifle, bows and arrows. So the fights could be more structured in such a way that more easily followed. This movie, since they're slaughtering 300, it's not followable the way a Zatoichi or a Lone Wolf and Cub or even a Kirishiro Nomura Son of Black Mass movie is easily followed. But it's still followable. It's still beautifully done. It's still the accomplishment of slaughtering 300 people at the end of a movie, which is filled with slaughters. I think the movie's like 2.5 hours long, and it's filled with action and drama and coolness. And I can recommend it very highly, if not extremely highly. So let me wrap this baby up. There's going to be a lot of on the supplementals, obviously, with that we saw Coco between the ending of the recording yesterday with Miko and Jen, and today we three saw Miko, and that is quite a film. There's a lot of action in it. It could be considered an action movie as well as many other kinds of movies. It's a fantasy, it's a horror, it's a mystery, it's a romance, it's a family drama. It's really an incredible film. It's one of my favorite kinds of films because it's cumulative. It builds and builds and builds and builds and builds and pays off at the end. A lot of movies that I don't appreciate start with the best action at the beginning and then just sort of dribbles away for the rest of the film. It starts high and ends low. For at least a decade, I could review virtually every movie by saying started well, ended not so well. But this movie, it starts beautifully. This movie is a lot like Miyazaki, who is the great Japanese animator. In his last film, The Spirit Rises, he was just kind of showing off. He was just saying, this is all everything I've learned in terms of how I do animation. And I'm just going to subtly put it into the film. And you can accept it or not accept it. And I who have studied animation and wrote a book on animation that was never published, but was 1 week away from publication, no animation. And I watched The Spirit Rises with my jaw dropping. Coco, Pixar's Coco, is not subtle about its beauty. It basically explodes like a autumn forest in front of your eyes, just endlessly beautiful, stunningly beautiful, as I would even say ridiculously beautiful. I was again with Miko, and Miko is sitting between me and Jen, and Jen is a story person at Blue Sky Studios, and Miko's an animator, and he had to swallow several times. He would drop his head and gasp at different points in this film. It is really visually splendid, and the plot is so amazing in terms of how there's a point about midway through where I was going, I don't know about this. And it takes, there'll be spoilers. It takes a turn near the end, which took me by surprise and a little shock. And I was on the edge of disappointment. I was going, this is, you know, I'm not too cool with this. But then they built on it and built on it and built on it. And because as an animator, you have complete control of your actors, they made it work in no uncertain terms by the ending. The ending has a emotional wallop. If you remember Pixar's Up, there's a lump in the throat and tears at the beginning. But here they save the emotional wallop to the end. And I've read articles about, yeah, you are the guy sobbing at Coco. Coco is pretty amazing, and the action is pretty darn good. And again, they have control, and they're dealing with a lot more control than a normal movie, because most of this movie involves skeletons, because it takes place during the Day of the Dead, the Mexican Day of the Dead, and the leading character goes into the land of the dead. Yeah, already you can see it's a pretty challenging film. And so not only are these is there action and fighting and other things, but it's mostly done with skeletons. And in case one human boy who is slowly turning into a skeleton, it's really remarkable and extraordinary, and many other words like that. One of the things I love about not using the word unbelievable, which so many people overuse now, is that what's so great about Coco is it is believable. It's not unbelievable. Humans did this. And that brings us down to the final point, which we started this whole thing with. Hours prior to going to see Coco, the word came down that James Lasseter, the creative director of the Disney World, the Walt Disney Animation, as well as Pixar. He started with Pixar, and then when Pixar was bought by Disney, he became the overhead. John Lasseter has taken a leave of absence for what has been widely quoted as missteps. He's part of this ongoing purging, which I think is a good thing, of the sexual harassing leaders of Hollywood. And it's just sad. It's very sad and tragic that it's him, the head of this company that is so important for my entertainment life, because in Disney I trust. And I just spoke at the Walt Disney Animation Studios in October. Lasseter was not in attendance. But I was at that time hoping that he would see, because they videotaped my talk, and I was hoping he'd see it, because I wanted them to take what I said and incorporate it into movies like the upcoming live-action Mulan and other things. And now to hear that he has been acting inappropriately, the best term that I can come up with for what he was supposedly, allegedly doing is being handsy. It's most interesting because ultimately Coco addresses this. The core situation in the movie, there'll be spoilers, I'm sorry, but it's important for the point that I'm making. The leading character, or one of the leading characters, the character, just like in Frozen, there was a Frozen Frozen featurette that played before Coco, which I always thought was very smart, because a lot of families might not just automatically go to an animated movie with their family if they're not Mexican or don't have interest in Mexican mysticism or music or history, but they attached Olaf's Frozen Adventure, the new featurette about with the characters from Frozen, on the front of Coco. It plays before Coco, and I thought that was a very wise business decision. And in that, if you'll recall, in Frozen, the leading hero, the love interest, the one who's supposedly going to have true love's kiss, turns out to be a villain. And the same sort of thing happens in Coco. And I found that very interesting, considering that their creative director had a guilty secret, which was in plain view, but basically he was daring anyone to call him on it. And he comes off as a great father and a great grandfather and a great loving uncle, the way Disney did. Most people know that Disney had some issues, not with being handsy, but with the kind of people he professed to disliking and would work actively against, apparently. But this is a situation where he was taking advantage of his position, and he was going, "What? I wasn't doing anything. I was just being friendly," that kind of thing. But again, he was in a position where he was daring anybody to say anything about it. And that is unfortunate and shameful and sad. And I find it most interesting that both Frozen and Coco had that aspect of a hero with clay feet, if that's the proper phrase. So on that happy note, happy Thanksgiving, or happy post-après Thanksgiving. I'm recording this the day before Thanksgiving, and I look forward to hoping that you will be here to hear what we have to say, or someone has to say. It'll probably involve me in a fortnight, as they say, and as Pierce Brosnan might say. And until then, just remember, I'm saying this more and more in my car every day, at least 3 times every time I get behind the wheel. So please listen to me and please do as I ask. You, your blinking jacket.
Okay, break it up, break it up. For now.
You don't give up, do you?
Listen in next time for more Film Fun, Frenzy, and Friends. Until then, check out actionfilmautopsy.com, where the excitement never ends.
Sonic Victory.